Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author. Each week, Dr. Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest on a range of compelling topics, from literature to psychology to financial wellness. To learn more about Dr. Crosby's behavioral finance work at Orion, visit www.orion.com.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby, and I am joined today by Anne Garcia. Anne is a partner at Independent Progressive Advisors in Portland. She is the author of the new book, How to Pay for College, and she has helped thousands of families save millions of dollars on college. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So congratulations on the book. I was absolutely no help. Anne called me and is like, hey, I'm about to put my book in the world and I'm worried because I'm going to want to go back and redo everything. What did you do when you had those feelings? And I said, I never had those feelings. I just thought it was awesome. And I just put it out in the world. So Anne is much less overconfident than me. She's a much better writer. And she's here today to talk to us about how to send folks to college on the cheap. So Anne, am I correct in my intuition that this is an era of particular anti-college sentiment? It feels like there's been some blowback or some pushback against going to college lately. Is that your perception or am I off there?
Well, I think it's a great question. And I would say yes and no. I mean, let's be honest, anti-intellectualism sort of is a strain throughout American history, and the current era is no exception to that. But we're also right now in this era where we hate everyone who isn't like us. And we often do that by assigning labels, and college is one of those labels. So while I would agree that there's a good share of anti-elite blowhardism, you know, directed at colleges currently, I'd also say two things. So first, the stakes are a lot higher for education right now, in part because costs are so high, but also because the rewards are so high. You know, the divergence in path between college educated and non-college educated is pretty stark. So we're not just demanding that our kids go to college, we're also demanding that colleges produce good outcomes for them, and we're getting really angry when they don't. And those who don't go or feel that they don't have access get angry that they're not participating in the benefits of education. The other thing is we're starting to see really significant reconsideration or revision of educational requirements for different careers, and those are going up and down. So on the one hand, you see, for example, the state of Maryland recently removed college degree requirements from a lot of career paths and replaced that with experience. And hopefully that's the start of a trend. But on the other hand, you see fields like healthcare where they're increasing degree requirements in areas like nursing and pharmacy and physical therapy, making it, you know, much more difficult to join those fields. But I think part of the challenge with education in our country, not just with education, but with the perception of education, is that given minimal federal support and declining state support, we don't have the public investment or buy-in to align the educational system with societal needs. So we have colleges serving customers, which, you know, to them are their students and prospective students, rather than serving society. Now, many colleges perceive society as their customer and their constituent and act accordingly. But we don't have a system where, for example, you know, we say, oh, we need more engineers, so let's have more slots at engineering schools and let's hire more engineering faculty. Or, you know, we have a nursing shortage, we're not creating more nursing schools. Instead, we have students from families of means deciding they want to study philosophy or classics or history. And so colleges offer philosophy and classics and history programs. As consumers paying high prices, and I speak for myself as a parent of college students, you know, we demand a high service level. And that's everything from, you know, nice dorms with great amenities to counselors and support services that ensure our students graduate in 4 years. And, you know, and then we have, you know, young adults taking on loans to get graduate degrees in social work. And as a society, we're offering H-1B visas so that we can import engineers because our educational system doesn't produce enough of them. So we have a disconnect between what our society needs from an educational system and what the system is producing and incentivized to produce. And so that may be more than just, do we have an anti-education?
So it's interesting you bring this up. This is nothing I've ever thought about. And my psychology undergraduate took your comments very, very personally. No, but
I was a history major, so
I'm looking at my family. I think we've got history, psychology, and rhetoric, I think, are the three that I can call to mind. So, you know, that's very much to your point. But if we wanted to align, because there's an element of personal agency in there, right? But if we wanted to align societal needs or economic needs more closely with colleges, what would we do? Just offer incentives, offer more scholarships for STEM type careers?
Well, I'd say we'd have to start with a higher level of public funding for education, because, you know, we can't tell Stanford as a private entity, you need to produce this many engineers. But, you know, if you look back to earlier years, you know, for example, in California, the California Master Plan for Higher Education really laid out a system to get the young people of California educated so that there was an educated workforce that would drive the economic engine of California. And that's been a hugely successful experiment. You know, if you compare the economy of a state like California with virtually any other one, where there was a very high level of alignment between education policy and the economic needs of the state. And we just don't have that level of public support of education anymore.
Well, so, you know, I'm put in mind of a second question. So that's sort of at the macro societal level, right? There's this misalignment. How do you counsel folks at the micro individual family level? Because I think, you know, this is a conversation my wife and I have a lot. Her family and my family handled it very differently. Clearly, my family said, look, if you want to go get sort of a low probability of employment job, go ahead, you know, if this is your passion. And her family was very much of the mind that, like, if we're going to pay for this, if we're going to help you with college, you're coming out with marketing, nursing, engineering, business. I mean, there's something that's going to tie it very directly to a job. But when I think about my own path, which is, you know, perhaps an in of one and a mistake, but it's like if I had been forced into a career I was less passionate about, I would almost certainly be less professional. I would almost certainly make less money. Like, there's, how do you think about sort of the personal passion sort of angle versus the job security, get employment angle when counseling with families and kids?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's such a great point, and it's such a hard piece of it. I mean, as I said before, I was a history major in college, and there is actually absolutely no purpose to that other than that I learned to love education and love learning and to be curious and to know how to get answers to my questions and use that as a lever to go out and see the world and learn about what I wanted to do and turn it into a career path that has meandered a bit. We had a different set of choices available to us than our kids do because college was so much less expensive when we went. The stakes were not as high. I think, you know, for families, when you're looking at it, you are balancing that, you know, needing to get your money's worth out of this very expensive investment and needing to make sure that this experience called college helps your child to develop into the adult that you want them to be. And that's not just someone who knows how to be an engineer, but someone who knows how to function as an adult. And there's a lot of data out there that supports the idea that college produces good outcomes, not just economically, but also socially. So, you know, yes, college graduates earn more money, a lot more money over their lifetimes than non-college graduates. They have lower unemployment rates, but college graduates also are more likely to own homes. They live healthier lives. There's less type 2 diabetes, less heart disease among college graduates. College graduates marry at more at higher rates and divorce at lower rates than do non-college educated people, which is, I find that statistic really fascinating because something people talk about so much is how education gives you financial independence. And yet the financially independent people are more likely to partner up, and not just to partner up, but to stay partnered. So college is absolutely, you know, you're right to want this for your child. The flip side of it is your child is going to be best served not by what school they go to, but by how much student loan debt they leave school with. You know, so your goal as a parent should be, number one, to get your child an education that sets them up for their life in the world, whether that's college or a different pathway. And number two, to minimize the drag that creates on their future.
I love some of what you brought up, because I was thinking about this almost from like the ancient Greek perspective of like, okay, so a history major, do they produce great economic prospects on average? Probably not. But do they create a great citizen, right? Like, are you a good member of your society? Are you a good voter?
I'd like to think I'm a good citizen.
And I think the answer is yes. And so I'm glad you touched on some of the non-financial benefits of going to college, because it is more than just the job, even though that job is a very big thing. It's fascinating to hear stuff like the marriage statistics. Are there any downsides to going to college outside of having to listen to your kids pontificate about their, you know, French existentialism after their first philosophy course? Are there any downsides about it?
My gosh, that's a real thing. And I mean, during the pandemic, when the kids were at home, we got it every night.
I was that guy.
On the other hand, it was so fun to like have them come to me and say, come sit in on my astronomy lecture. It's so interesting. there are definitely some groups that don't benefit from college. You know, those who start and don't finish are one of the big groups, and especially those who take out loans to do so, because they end up, you know, without the economic means to support that debt, and with that debt that often precludes them from doing things like buying houses, buying cars, you know, just taking those first steps towards economic stability. You know, other bad outcomes: for-profit colleges are a terrible outcome. You know, the predatory colleges that basically sell degrees that really aren't worth the, you know, the paper that they're printed on. You know, another big group are people who pursue non-lucrative careers that require graduate degrees, and, you know, social workers who need a master's degree and are going to make minimum wage for the rest of their life. So, you know, there's a common theme there of debt being a really negative outcome of college. And so, you know, in my book and in my work with clients, that's what I really try to counsel people on is making sure that you keep that piece of it to a minimum. I think another big negative with college, with so many people going to college, is it creates this sort of creeping degree requirement where, you know, I went to college, so I'm only going to hire people who went to college, because somehow I think that is a requirement for things. There are so many cases where jobs requiring a degree don't actually require a college education, but that is, you know, one of those just sort of creeping negatives, you know, negative spinoffs of having a highly educated workforce. Unfortunately, you know, we're seeing a lot of those requirements, areas like programming and coding, change, but college produces a lot more positive outcomes, excuse me, than negative ones.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, I get approached by a lot of people who want to go get, degrees in the social sciences, of course. And what I say to them is, look, like, if you're not ready to go 7-8 years, like, that's how long it's going to be before you're employable. So like, think about the debt you'll incur over that time. Think about the slog, like, is your life set up? I mean, I started my PhD when I was 23. I mean, I can't imagine trying to do it today with kids. I mean, it would be a very different animal. So I think these are all good things to consider. you know, I'm glad we have experts like you to write books and help clueless people like me, because I'm just shooting from the hip with my own kids when it comes to college. And so I'm going to tell you what I've told my kids when it comes to prestige, and you tell me if I'm way off base and need to change my course. My admonition to my kids has been to just go somewhere affordable, like go to a state school, you know, go to a state school and get your undergraduate degree. And then if you want to go to Harvard for law school, or, you know, to get an MBA or whatever, then go get the prestige. But like, learn how to be an adult, learn how to sort of cut your teeth on the college experience at a more affordable, less prestigious university, you know, rather than incurring six figures of debt for an undergraduate degree that probably has questionable employment prospects. Speak to prestige, if you will. How important is it? How important is it at the undergraduate level, at the graduate level? Does it matter as much as we think?
So yeah, that's such a great topic. I'm glad you brought it up. I mean, I think college is one of the areas in life where our behaviors are most likely to result in extremely bad outcomes. You know, the rational self and the this is not Homo economicus going through the college admissions process. Here in the US, we have a tendency to equate cost and exclusivity with quality. And I think nowhere is that more so than when it comes to college. But there's been a ton of research done showing that students don't experience different life outcomes based on what college they attend. So students who apply to the same set of colleges tend to have similar life trajectories regardless of what college they ultimately end up attending, and whether it's by their choice or whether it's due to not being admitted. So the fact that you're smart and ambitious enough to apply to Stanford is going to do more to shape your life than actually going to Stanford. One of the biggest studies on this topic, you know, success being tied to college experiences, was the Gallup Purdue Index. And they surveyed adults to determine what about their college experience made them successful in life. And what they found is it had nothing to do with what college they attended, what type of college they attended, what the location of their college was, but really was about six specific experiences that they either had or didn't have when they were in college. And these are people who, you know, defined themselves as being successful, were engaged in their careers, in their communities, and in their lives. And what they found was that it was six specific experiences. You know, one, feeling like professors cared about them. Two, having a professor who made them excited about learning. Three, having a mentor who encouraged them to pursue their goals. Four, having an internship or job that let them apply what they were learning in the classroom. Five, participating actively in extracurriculars, and six, working on a project that took a semester or longer to complete. So none of that had anything to do with Harvard versus San Jose State. It was all about the types of experiences that the student had on campus. And I would say, you know, from my own life experience with my own two kids, I have twins, and one of them goes to a very prestigious school and one of them goes to a large state school. Both are great fits for them. But both of them this summer had internships at Fortune 500 companies. So very, very similar paths. They're studying different fields. The one that went to a state school, I think he even made a little bit more than the one who went to a more prestigious school. But if you look at it across the board, you know, Fortune 500 CEOs, the school that produced the most of them, Penn State, far more than Harvard or Stanford. If you look at Rhodes Scholars every year when those are announced, typically about half of the Rhodes Scholars are people who went to public universities that accept more than half of applicants. So you do not have to attend a prestigious college to have a good, you know, to be a successful adult. And then when you look at graduate school, you know, Harvard Business School typically admits students from 250 or so different undergraduate institutions. So, you know, a friend of ours was given the guidance, since his goal was to go to a business school, was that he would be better off going to University of Oregon if he wanted to apply to top business schools than Berkeley or UCLA, which were his top two choices, because he'd be one of a fewer pool of Oregon graduates applying to those business schools.
So interesting. I love those studies you shared, especially the six sort of predictors. And it really is more about, you know, from the sound of it, more about the fit and the experiential elements of it than kind of the crest or like the prestige of the institution itself. That's really fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, you want to be in a place where you're going to engage in your surroundings. I heard someone else put said, how did they put it? It was much more funny than how I'm going to say it, but it was like, if you want your kid to have a great college experience, get them into the worst dorm they can be in, because then they won't want to be in their room.
Right. Right. Yes. Get out to the library. Don't be hanging out in the dorm. So we're talking on an auspicious and an important day because we've had a big announcement with respect to college debt today. So President Biden announced that there would be, what, $10,000 of debt forgiven for those owing money and making less than $125,000 a year. Predictably, we've seen every sort of response to this. You know, I've seen individual, tearful individual anecdotes of people whose lives will be bettered by this. I've seen critiques of this and saying it needed to be much higher than $10,000 because so many people owe such enormous sums. I've seen people say that, look, only about a quarter of people graduate or go to college. So this is sort of helping people who are already at the top of the heap. You're sort of giving an extra leg up to people who are already sort of the intellectual cream of the country, and you're helping people who don't necessarily need help. How do you think about this? I'm going to talk about paying for college now, but you know, it would be crazy not to talk about this on this day, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to bring up a couple statistics that I think are relevant to this. And I'm going to start with an editorial, which is that the vast majority of people who are complaining about student loan forgiveness are people who, like me, attended college when it cost $500 a semester to go. And so we were never in the position of having to borrow at the rate that kids today do. So a couple statistics. One is that a third of borrowers owe $10,000 or less. So a big part of the student loan forgiveness was dealing with the fact that multiple loan servicers have exited the business over the last couple of years because the federal government has mandated that they act in the interest of students, not in the interest of themselves. So there's a huge logistical bottleneck in the system that part of this is designed to alleviate. The other thing is, for all the talk about these massive student loan balances, about two-thirds of the people who are in forbearance or who pre-pandemic were struggling with loans, who were in default, were people who owed $20,000 or less. So this is a program that is going to have a meaningful impact on large numbers of people. Now, there were a lot of larger balances that were already forgiven through public service loan forgiveness, temporary waiver program, or that are in the process of being forgiven. So that is providing a lot of relief to, you know, the teachers and nurses and other people like that who had large student loan balances. This is more targeted at, you know, number one, alleviating stress on the system, because restarting all these payments is going to be a massive, massive undertaking, particularly with a smaller number of servicers, and helping out people who are truly struggling with their loans, because at $20,000 of balance, you're not eligible for income-based repayment or any of those other things. And many of those are people who did not complete their college degree because the financial burden of attending was so great. So I do think this is a program that will provide meaningful relief to a meaningful number of people. I would like, as a citizen of a society that requires an increasingly educated workforce, I would like future efforts to be put on reining in the cost of college so that we don't put young people in this situation. And, you know, another interesting learning from research is that the availability of student loans has been a factor in driving up the cost of college. So every time the amount that you can borrow in the federal student loan programs goes up, the cost of college goes up by a comparable amount. So part of the reason for the high cost of college is the availability of this money. By bringing down, you know, by reducing the cost of college and reducing the reliance and need for that money, hopefully we can avert this problem in the future.
Yeah, that was sort of my follow-on question is I saw, I'm going to mess all the numbers up, but I saw a graphic the other day that was talking about if everyday items cost as much, if everyday, the price of everyday items had risen at the same rate of college, and it was like, you know, $20 for a tank of, for a gallon of gas and $50 for a beer or what, you know, whatever. I mean, it was just extraordinary. So is it the easy money that has caused college costs to grow so precipitously? Because it's not, you know, I used to be a professor. I have family members who are professors. It's not because teachers are getting paid so much. So what is it that's causing, you know, class costs to rise so dramatically?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are so many reasons for it. And yes, the availability of money is one of them. I mean, we could talk policy and lazy rivers and dorms all day long, but I think there's a really important point that we tend to overlook in this. Lots and lots of families are willing to pay $80,000 a year for college. And as long as that's the case, why would colleges charge less than that? You know, We live in a society where we talk all day long about providing great education and for everyone, but what we really want is really good education for everyone and really great education for our own kids. Mm. And people are willing to pay for that. I mean, you look at it in elementary school, all the tutoring and private coaching and stuff that you get all through the early grades rather than, you know, supporting our schools, you know, the auctions and PTA raffles and everything else instead of raising taxes to fund education. But the truth is that at any of the most selective colleges, and this is not just the Ivy Leagues, but a wide range of highly selective colleges, somewhere between a quarter and a third of students are paying full price to go there. And their families are approaching the college admissions process with the intention of paying full price if it means their student will get something that's air quotes better than others. And so if you're a college president at a school that cost $80,000 last year and you were turning people away, what are you going to charge next year? Not $75,000, right? You know, you can keep driving that up. But the other thing that I think is really important to understand is there's a huge difference between the list price of college and what people actually pay. So on the one hand, list price for colleges have gone up 5-6% annually for a very, very long time, and driven by many, many factors, to me, chief among them, willingness of people to pay that. But on the other hand, net tuition revenue, which is the amount that colleges actually get paid by the students, has remained flat for about a decade. Mm. So last year, the average tuition discount was more than 50%. Mm. So that means that although list prices are going up, what we actually pay isn't, because more than half of the tuition that's charged isn't being paid. And it's a real testament to the opacity of the system that you probably didn't know that.
So are there tricks of the trade to try and get you to not pay this? I know certain schools will say, look, you don't have to pay in-state tuition. Like, you know, I live in Georgia. Georgia has the pays for school with the lottery. So if you're in Georgia and you have good grades, you can go to school for free. So that's pushed a lot of students to Alabama and Tennessee and other places who didn't have the grades to go here for free. So then the Alabama schools start waiving out-of-state tuition. Are there tricks of the trade? Is it as easy as just asking? Like, how do we get these markdowns?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think that there's a couple steps for families to take to find the best scholarships. The first is, you know, understand that the best scholarships come from the colleges themselves. Like you said, you know, good students get in free at Georgia, you know, the school is covering the cost of tuition. So the best scholarships come from the colleges themselves, but it's up to them to decide who gets those scholarships and how it awards its dollars. So the first step for a family is to figure out what scholarships you're eligible for. Are you eligible for need-based scholarships? Or are you eligible for merit scholarships? And then look for colleges that offer that kind of scholarship. So the easy way to figure out if you're eligible for need-based scholarship is to go to the Federal Student Aid website and do their tool called the Student Aid Estimator. And that will tell you what your expected family contribution is. That's the amount that the federal methodology says that your family should be able to pay for college every year. If it's less than the cost of college, then you're eligible for need-based aid. And then you need to look for schools that offer need-based aid. If it's more than the cost of college, or if you want to go to colleges that don't offer need-based aid, then you need to look for merit scholarships. And merit scholarships are typically awarded to the top quartile of students at the college. Sometimes it's automatic. You know, if you have X GPA, it's, you know, you get this discount, Y GPA gets this discount. I mean, my son goes to an out-of-state public school where he got a nice big scholarship because of his grades. And so that's really the easiest way to do it. Do the net price calculator. Every school is required to have one. That tells you what a family like yours would pay to send their kid to that college. Those are two really, really good resources for finding scholarships. I think another thing that parents should do is look up their in-state public colleges scholarship programs. Like, you know what it is in Georgia. I know it is what it is in Oregon, so that you can make sure that your kid is on the path to have the GPA that they will need to get those scholarships. But the other really important thing for families to do is be transparent with your kids about what level of financial support you're willing to provide for their education, so that they're not surprised when they've gone and applied to expensive schools. You know, they're not surprised to learn that you can't pay for them.
So let's talk about that for a minute. You're an advisor. You don't need any updating on sort of the retirement crisis and the lack of preparation the average American family has for their future. For the average family who is going to have relatively modest savings, be what, in their 40s or 50s when they're sending a kid to college, not so close to retirement, but again, not so far away either. How do they think about whether or not to help their kids pay for college if they aren't themselves sort of financially independent, which of course most folks won't be? Yeah. So how do we think about that?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I mean, there are so many pathways available to students, and those pathways are available at so many different price points. And, you know, and I'm not even talking about college versus not college. Even within the scope of college, there are lots and lots of options available to students. You know, on the one hand, you have colleges that are very generous with need-based financial aid. And so students should not shy away from applying to four-year colleges just on the basis of cost, but they should be doing net price calculators to figure out what those colleges will cost them. There are great pathways like free community college. Oftentimes you can combine that with a dual enrollment program where you attend community college adjacent to a four-year college and can fully participate in the college life that's at the four-year college. But really, you know, families with need to be factoring that into their college selection process. So look for colleges that meet full need with grants only. And you can Google colleges that meet full need with grants only, and you will see a list of them. Look for state grant awards, especially for students in higher cost of living states like California or New York, where you're not going to be eligible for need on the federal, you know, on the federal scale, but your state will have grants that support people at higher income levels than that. Look for colleges. You know, if you're a student who's taking a lot of AP or IB classes or other advanced classes, look for colleges that'll give you credit for those so that you can graduate in 3 years instead of four, because not all do. The thing you can't do is take for granted that because I have financial need, I can go wherever I want and I'm going to get great scholarships, because not all colleges provide that. But many, many do. And there are many, many great pathways for students. And again, what college you go to is not going to be the thing that determines who you are as a person. Who you are as a person is going to be enhanced by going to college and by finding a college that's a good fit for you, that gets you a good education, that you graduate.
My sister-in-law had this knack for finding these really strange, sort of out of the way scholarships. She was a pianist and got all sorts of sort of fine arts scholarships and different things. My own family has sponsored a scholarship for the last 4 years that's very niche, right? I mean, it's for Latter-day Saint psychologists in training. I mean, it couldn't be more niche. And so when you think about, there's this world of very quirky, small scholarships that exists out there. How can students sort of get their arms around these opportunities that may be under the radar?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So there are lots and lots of scholarships out there. Those types of scholarships tend to be less generous than the ones that are offered by the college. So I would say generally you can see those as supporting your pathway, not determining your pathway. Yeah. I think personally, so there are great websites like FastWeb and Scholly that have massive databases of scholarships that you can search and find 10 million things that you're eligible for. The problem is there's 10 million other people doing exactly the same thing. I think the best place to start looking for scholarships is at your high school, in your high school's guidance counselor office, because there are tons and tons of little local scholarships. You know, at our high school, there's one for someone on the tennis team. Well, guess what? There's 12 people on the tennis team. Right. And they're not all seniors. Yeah. You know, there are lots and lots of things like that where you're in a smaller pool of applicants, and chances are someone reading the applications knows you and knows what a great person you are and wants you to succeed and wants you to have this. And so to me, that's a really great starting point. My daughter, for example, found a terrific scholarship that her computer science teacher in high school recommended that she apply to. And she gets $5,000 a year plus a technology grant every year. And she got a professional mentor who found her an internship. And so, you know, so that's been great, but that's not the thing that would have made, you know, close the gap between a much more expensive school and the one that she chose. It was something that supports her on the path that she's on. So check in your guidance counselor's office, ask teachers, if you participate in club sports or whatever activities you participate in, ask the people involved with those about scholarships that they know about that you might be eligible for.
Yeah, I like that. The low-hanging fruit may be right there at the high school. The tennis team scholarship is incredible, but you know, it might be right there at the high school. And it's more icing than cake, though. This isn't going to be the thing that should decide your path, but it's a nice to have if you can.
That's a great analogy. It is more icing than cake. The cake comes from the schools themselves.
Sure. Perfect. So the last question here, Anne, is, you know, I know less than a handful of advisors who go pretty hard with college planning as a value add and as a real differentiator. At the risk of training up your competition here, what can advisors do to add more value here and incorporate college planning and guidance into their businesses?
Yeah, I would love to see more doing it. I'm glad to see it is getting a lot more focus among the advisory community. I think it's impossible to serve Gen X or millennial clients if you can't give them guidance around planning what for most families is their second largest savings goal after retirement. So I would say a few things. You know, one is lean into the process rather than trying to game the system. So many advisors focus on like getting their clients to use Roth IRAs instead of 529s because they think it's better for the FAFSA, but they overlook the fact that the client has $500,000 in income, so they're not going to get need-based aid anyway. You know, help your clients to save because more savings gives you more choices. And along the lines of helping your clients save, have a 529 that you recommend, whether it's your in-state plan or a different one, but help them get started saving and help them build up their savings over time. And secondly, help your clients understand the components of a college budget. So savings is part of it, spending from your cash flow is part of it, tax credits, scholarships, all those things. Know how the FAFSA works, what it does and doesn't do, and the types of scholarships that are available and who gets them. I think a lot of people treat the FAFSA like it's the tooth fairy, and it really is not. It's just one of the tools in the application process. But I think most importantly, help your clients to be successful. So too many advisors tell parents, okay, you want your kids to go to private school? Well, it's $80,000 a year now, 6% inflation rate, 18 years from now means, you know, you have to save $2,000 a month, every month from the month your child is born in order to pay for it. Actually, you don't, and you probably can't. So, you know, this person is going to start out feeling defeated, you know, throw in the towel, probably not do the basic getting started stuff that would lead to really good outcomes. I don't think we ever saved more than $200 per month for our kids, and both of them are going to graduate debt-free. One of them is going to graduate debt-free from the world's most expensive university. So, you know, help them to be successful. And of course, read my book and take my online course.
Love it. We were headed there. I love it. So, you know, in terms of this, we're always complaining as an industry about how we're left behind by the next generation. Like, I think advisors often don't attend to the younger generation. And then when the clients pass on, then they, you know, we know that 90%+ of the time, the surviving spouse or the kids move on to a new advisor. And I think it's because we haven't perhaps been integrated enough in the lives of that next generation. This seems like a very, very not easy perhaps, but a very sensible way to get involved and to really give them life skills that will serve them well going forward and make them the great clients of the future and help the family in a real way.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, college planning is a terrific way to initiate intergenerational planning conversations. You know, you have a grandparent who's your client who's interested in helping the grandkids. That's a terrific time to invite the whole family in for a conversation, or each of, you know, set up a call with the parents of the children along with the grandparents to talk about what their educational goals are and how the parents are, you know, what level of comfort the parents have and to what degree they're hoping to get support. And it lets you get an insight into the next generation's financial circumstances that can help you to guide them along the best path in supporting that child.
Yeah, absolutely.
Grandchildren.
Absolutely. So folks, not every book you buy is going to have the kind of payoff that Anne's book will have. I mean, you're going to spend $20 and it could give you the sort of insights and tips and tricks that could save you many, many times that. So Anne, you've been awesome. Tell us the name of the book one more time. Where can we find you? Where can we learn more about you and your work?
Yeah. So the book is How to Pay for College. It's available from Amazon, bookshop.org, wherever you buy books. My website is howtopayforcollege.com as well, where I have tons and tons of information about the college planning process, including an online course that's designed for high school age families of high school age students who are really just trying to get the plan together all at once. I also have a Facebook page, The College Financial Lady, which was my original name, which my editor of my book thought was ridiculous. but I'll be having a bunch of Facebook Live events around the college planning process there this fall.
So I'm cracking up here because Anne and I share an editor, and The Laws of Wealth was original. I wanted it to be called, like, I was trying to emphasize sort of the power of patience and doing nothing. And I'm going to mess up the name, but I wanted to be called something like Fat, Lazy, and Rich or something like that. And he, our very proper British editor, wanted nothing to do with that title. So whether it's The College Financial Lady or the much more absurd Fat, Lazy, and Rich, he wanted nothing to do with that. Well, I can vouch firsthand for the fact that it's an incredible book. And thank you for all the wisdom you shared with us today. Hope you sell a ton of copies.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.